now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, privatization, competition, possibly drugs from Canada. Medicare reform gets a presidential push.
Our seniors should not have to wait for an act of Congress for improvements in their health care.
Democratic candidates declare if Florida holds a straw poll, they'll skip the convention.
The race for governor in Mississippi, it's a nasty one.
And a voice from Iraq, silenced.
I want to live as a human being. I don't need more strict limitations. I would like to travel. I would like to behave as a man, not as an animal.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Cooler air from the Pacific Ocean is moving into Southern California, but the wind may start pushing wildfires in a new direction, toward the east and toward more bone-dry land. At least 16 people have died since October 21st because of the fires. More than 1,600 homes have burned to the ground. Reporter Russell Lewis of member station KPBS says firefighters do not know when they'll be able to contain the biggest wildfire in the state, the Cedar Fire.
They really don't have any idea. Yesterday at this time, they thought they really had a handle on it. And then as the day went on, the fire shifted and changed directions radically. It swallowed up the town of Lake Cuyamaca. About 150 structures were destroyed there in a heartbeat. Those are homes, as well as the volunteer fire station also were burned yesterday. And the flames have been steadily marching toward the mountain town of Julian. Right now, fire crews have sort of cut a fire break all the way around that town, hoping to save it. Some structures, some buildings, some homes have burned in the Julian area, but the historic downtown part of Julian is still okay, and they're calling it the last stand for Julian.
Russell Lewis reporting. California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger is on Capitol Hill, making his first appearance since Californians chose him to replace recalled Democratic Governor Gray Davis. Schwarzenegger is using his visit to seek money for his fire-ravaged state. NPR's David Wellna reports from the Capitol.
It's a long-standing tradition for newly elected California governors to come to the Capitol to meet with the state's 55 federal lawmakers. But the fires raging in Southern California added a tone of urgency to Schwarzenegger's mission. He spoke here with reporters after meeting with House GOP members.
You know, even though it's very sad of what's going on in California, but at the same time, there's a happy moment also when you come here and you ask for help. And people open up their arms and says, we are there with you. We're going to help California. So that has been the message in all my meetings this morning.
California's two Democratic senators are urging Schwarzenegger, who will take office in 3 weeks, to obtain federal funds for so-called one-stop service centers for victims of the fires. He promised he'll seek federal help to quickly rebuild homes and businesses that were destroyed. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Defense Department says 115 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the beginning of May. That's more than the number killed during major fighting in Iraq, a phase President Bush declared was over on May 1st. Major fighting began on March 20th. Two soldiers were killed last night in Iraq when their tank was hit by a bomb on the side of the road north of Baghdad. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 5 points at 97.43. The Nasdaq is also down 5 points at 1,926. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the board of Palm has voted to divide the firm into separate hardware and software companies. The hardware company will be known as Palm One. The software firm will be called Palm Source. Jason Lopez reports from San Francisco.
Palm One, which now includes the assets of former rival Handspring, faces fierce competition from Dell and Hewlett-Packard and consumer electronics firms as well as makers of smartphones. And the company faces another challenge. Handheld computers overall have not sold well over the past 2 years. Palm Source, the software maker, is in a market that analysts once thought could have been dominated the way Microsoft monopolized desktop computers. But that window appears to have passed. Microsoft and Symbian are vying for a piece of the operating system market for wireless devices. Analysts say Palm One and Palm Source face challenges, but separately should be able to compete better in the marketplace. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
Today, the Senate will review how college football champions are determined. To qualify for an elite bowl game, a college team must finish in the top six in the bowl championship series rankings. This method favors colleges that are members of six strong football conferences and the University of Notre Dame. Other colleges that don't belong to these conferences want to know if the arrangement violates antitrust laws. 5 years ago, undefeated Tulane University won the Liberty Bowl. Tulane was shut out of more prestigious bowl games because the slots had been taken by big-name teams, even though those big-name teams had lost some games. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is now down 7 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush said he wants more health care choice for seniors and to help them pay for prescription drugs in a Rose Garden address this morning. This as lawmakers on Capitol Hill continued struggling toward a compromise bill on Medicare just weeks before Washington shuts down for its traditional month-long holiday recess. Here's President Bush speaking this morning.
We're applying a basic principle. Seniors should be able to choose the kind of coverage that works best for them, instead of having that choice made by the government. Every member of Congress gets to choose a health coverage plan that makes the most sense for them. So does every federal employee. If this kind of coverage is good enough for the United States Congress, it's good enough for America's seniors.
Los Angeles Times reporter Vicki Kemper covers Medicare and attended the president's speech. Welcome, Vicki.
Thank you.
Vicki, this Republican president has to be concerned that the prescription drug bill he's promised remains stalled in a Republican Congress. Is it your sense he moved anything forward this morning?
Well, I don't think he did. He did not get into the specifics of the bill at all. He did not talk about the issues that continue to divide the negotiators from the House and the Senate.
Well, what's going on here, Vicki? There's been an outcry from many Republicans in Congress for more of a hands-on approach from the president to move this bill along?
Well, Democrats are calling for that, too. The problem for the president, I believe, is that there are some very significant differences both within his party, Republicans in the House and the Senate, and Republicans even within the House itself.
What are those big
differences? What should be done.
Yeah, Vicki, what are those big differences now? The House and Senate passed their Medicare bills back in June. What's holding up a final bill?
Well, one of the major differences that continues to divide both sides is a Republican plan to promote competition between the traditional Medicare program and HMOs and PPOs, private health plans. And Democrats are concerned that that would raise premiums, it would make the costs higher for seniors who want to stay with traditional Medicare, and it might force some of them to go into HMOs and PPOs who don't really want to do that.
Yeah, and there are some rather surprising things in these bills. Republicans calling for means testing or richer Americans don't pay for their drugs, and even provisions for Americans to buy their drugs in Canada?
Well, the means testing provision was part of the House bill, and like many of the controversial provisions, was not part of the Senate bill. The thinking there is that two things. One, the Medicare program already is financially strapped. It's the hospital fund is scheduled to go broke in 2026. And so part of their thinking is that some people who are toward the upper end of the income scale for seniors, should pay a greater share of their costs and taxpayers should pay less.
And what about this Canadian business?
Well, as you know, drugs in Canada are quite a bit cheaper than they are here in the United States, and many seniors, especially those in the border states, already go to Canada to buy their prescription drugs and save hundreds of dollars a year. And so there are provisions that would allow drugs made in the United States but then exported to Canada to be reimported back into this country and sold at a lower cost.
What do you think, just to finish up quickly, are we going to get a bill before Congress recesses in November?
I think right now the chances are about 50-50.
Vicki Kemper, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Vicki Kemper covers Medicare issues for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us from Washington.
The worst seems to be over. Yesterday, a giant spot on the surface of the sun rotated around to point directly at the Earth and let loose. The massive eruption sent a cloud of gas and charged particles hurtling towards us at more than a million miles an hour. There were fears that the resulting magnetic storm could disrupt communications and knock out satellites, but the peak of the storm seems to have passed with little damage reported. David Hathaway is a solar physicist at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. David, this is quite a week for you.
Has been a double hit.
Well, because you had two.
Yes, it was two spots, one that erupted last week, and then as that one was erupting, we could see this one coming around, and now it's centered on the disk and even more ferocious than the last one.
How did it impact us?
It impacts our satellite, and the satellite I use for observing the sun, the SOHO satellite, this one swamped its detectors. We knew it was coming, and again, it did create a geomagnetic storm that hit the top of our scale, and that was a little earlier today that actually hit.
Hmm. How much radiation does hit the Earth when this happened?
This one was massive. The radiation level at the satellite orbits where most of our communication satellites are was more than 100,000 times higher than the normal background.
Hmm. What about us when it hits us on Earth?
Well, we're nicely protected by our own magnetic field and our atmosphere. Hmm. So that radiation doesn't reach us here on the ground. At higher latitudes and higher elevations, it does. So if the Concorde were still flying, the Concorde actually does have problems with things like this. If they have to drop to a lower altitude because they have radiation detectors that say, hey, it's getting hot, you better drop.
But it also is a reminder that it could have knocked out many more satellites and it could have disrupted communications. Is it possible to protect communication satellites from these flares?
Yes, it is. There are some instruments that if you just shut them down and wait for it to pass, they'll survive just fine. There are other ways of actually reorienting the satellite so it's got more protection between its sensitive parts and the onslaught. There are things that satellite operators can do. They keep track of space weather, as we call this.
Mm. And you mentioned you saw the giant cloud coming, but what's it like to see this thing explode out of the sun? Could you see that?
It is pretty spectacular seeing, first of all, this huge spot on the disk of the sun, and then it erupt, and we see the X-rays within 8.5 minutes, and you see a cloud of material growing bigger and bigger as it comes towards us, and it gets extremely large, and about the time it fills the field of view that we have on SOHO, the SOHO detectors themselves get hit, so you just see the shower of snow on the images as the image detectors are actually being hit by energetic particles.
Well, David, thank you.
Good talking with you.
David Hathaway from the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama.
Very great to feel that at last you got your freedom. I'm full of proudness, full of happiness, full of pleasure. What can I say more?
The voice of Ahmed Shawkat, speaking last spring after witnessing the liberation of his country from Saddam Hussein. Ahmed Shawkat was an Iraqi biology professor and writer. He accompanied WBUR reporter Michael Goldfarb for 3 weeks during the war in Iraq and became the subject of the Inside Out documentary, Ahmed's War. Ahmed Shawkat had fulfilled his lifelong dream writing for a newspaper when he was killed Tuesday outside his office in Mosul. Reporter Michael Goldfarb joins us on the line from London.
Hello, Robin.
Well, first of all, we're so sorry. I know you're feeling this. What happened?
As best as we can tell, and information is sketchy, Ahmed was making a telephone call on his sat phone from the roof of his office building and was shot down. He had recently been writing some fairly stern editorials about Islamic terrorism, and the initial reports say that Islamists are suspected of the crime.
Mm. Who was Ahmed? Tell us a little bit about him.
His entire life was essentially a struggle to be able to assert himself against that regime. He was a university lecturer in biology, but he was, you know, a real intellectual, and he wrote poetry and wrote fiction, and he wrote, you know, political tracts. He was very influential with his students and had little political discussion groups. Eventually, he ran afoul of the regime, was imprisoned and tortured. He fought twice. He served twice in the Iran-Iraq War. The whole history of the last 30 years in Iraq was kind of tattooed on him. Ultimately, he wrote a piece of fiction that really angered the regime in the middle of the 1990s. He was imprisoned, probably would have been killed, except his family ransomed him for, you know, a massive sum of money, and he fled to the Kurdish safe area of northern Iraq in the late 1990s, and I met him 36 hours before the war began.
And I know he expressed to you the very simple things that he wanted. Let's listen to what he told you.
I want to live as a human being. I don't need more strict limitations. I would like to travel. I would like to behave as a man, not as an animal.
Simple, basic things, Robin. That's all the man wanted. And, you know, through all the years of living in a totalitarian dictatorship, he never stopped wanting those things or believing that someday he might actually get them.
And you also were able to capture the sheer joy that we heard as listeners when it was in sight. There was a point where you were talking to him. Was it outside of Mosul?
You know, and as the war progressed, and it became clear that he was going to be able to get back to his hometown in Mosul, he was incredibly excited, and we went out to see some fighting around a bridge, which was the only crossing over between Erbil and Mosul, and it was that had strategic importance, and he was irrepressible because he was closer to Mosul than he had been in years.
Can you see Mosul from here?
No, I can feel, of course, but I cannot see it.
You're smiling.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
We're on recon with Ahmed.
Michael, do you know how many children Ahmed left?
He left 8 children and 6 grandchildren.
Michael, as you know, there's a huge debate in this country about the success of the war in Iraq, whether or not people truly felt liberated and whether or not they now feel safe. What can we learn from Ahmed about answers to that question?
It's a process. You know, I don't think that the final page has been written. I know for a certainty, because we were in contact after I left Iraq, that he was incredibly happy to finally be able to run a newspaper, write what he pleased, and not have the state breathing down his neck or threatening to take away his livelihood or torture him. He was also completely aware of how difficult the task was to make people understand what democracy means. And I know that he never stopped being grateful for the fall of Saddam.
Well, Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb, and we leave you with the words of Ahmed Shawkat, the late Iraqi writer killed this week in Mosul.
They don't know how to have a clear dialogue between themselves or how to deal with the other countries, how to deal with the other peoples, how to negotiate between themselves. I hope I will be able to do something.
There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Most of us know what film noir is, those black and white films of the 40s and 50s in which a luscious femme fatale plays the leading man like a violin. And he's usually a cynical detective who thought he'd seen it all, at least until he saw, well, the femme fatale. Here's Orson Welles in Lady from Shanghai.
And for a while there, I thought it was me that was crazy. After what I'd been through, anything crazy at all seemed natural. But now, I was sane on one subject, her. I knew about her. She planned to kill Bannister.
Orson Welles in The Lady from Shanghai, which is a classic film noir. But there's also something our theater critic Bill Marx calls stage noir. He's here to talk about it now, and one new production in particular, the American premiere of the play The Black Dahlia, which is on stage at the Yale Repertory Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Bill, as I said, most of us have an idea what film noir is, but elaborate.
Well, I mean, essentially, it takes place after the war. It's a post-war phenomenon where you generally have an ambiguous moral atmosphere. When the GIs came back from the war, they found perhaps America not to be the same as when they left. And so the ideals of the war were worn down in what seemed to be an atmosphere of corruption, of sexual ambiguity, and perhaps promiscuity. So it's about a world in which one cannot tell the good and the bad from the bad very easily.
Now to the play, The Black Dahlia, American premiere, based on a book by mystery writer James Ellroy.
Right. He is a best-selling writer, and this was really the book that sort of put his name on the map. And it is based on an actual murder story in which a number of films and novels have been based on. The Black Dahlia, which was a young woman who was found mysteriously dead, gruesomely, in L.A. in the late 40s. And the play uses a lot of Ellroy's writings. And here, you can hear the technique as we discover the body in the play.
If a homicide like this gets a lot of publicity, we're going to get a lot of confessions. And we need information to eliminate the loonies with. So don't tell anyone about the state of this body. Not your wives, not your girlfriends, not other officers. I want you to stake up a crime scene perimeter. Any reporter who tries to cross it, you arrest them immediately.
New body cut in half, legs spread for sex, and worst of worst, the mouth cut ear to ear and a smile that leered at you.
That's just trash. McGee didn't do this. We'll let the lab men be the best judge of that.
Wow, that's grim stuff. Now, we also hear in the background the police sirens. There are movie screens on this stage, right?
There's a huge screen on top. So often there'll be glimpses of police cars and so forth, an attempt to give a sort of movie-like atmosphere to it, though. You also, of course, have the actors who are constantly coming back in different roles. So it's intensely theatrical as well as also trying to be filmic.
How does it work on stage when you're getting that sort of grim, that Hannibal Lecter-ish kind of quality in this thing?
Well, at the end of the play, some of the people were starting to giggle. There's an amazing image where, suddenly there's refrigerator doors open and they're sort of lit and there are these jars filled with human organs. And we're hearing, we're finding out who killed the Black Dahlia. And I think people, the feeling was a bit sometimes confusion. Some people were a bit, I have to say, were a little shocked. I mean, you occasionally hear someone gasp a little bit, which is sort of unusual in the theater. So it certainly had a lot of shock value. I just wonder ultimately you have the shock, and then when you go, where do you go from the shock? But it's very well done.
Now, this is not the sort of thing you saw in classic film noir. No. Dark films, but not explicit.
That, I think that Elroy is film noir meets Stephen King, meets the horror film. Yeah. In a sense, the ante has moved up from the old evils of the post-war era to now, you know, people aren't going to accept the sort of what were considered to be sort of the serial murders that got people hepped up in the 50s. I think now we need more and more ghoulish doings, you know, to make us feel that we've met the heart of darkness.
Not a night at the theater for your first date or your wedding anniversary or something.
No, but it is an interesting attempt. I mean, one of those things I went to, which I'm glad I saw, and I was fascinated by it, but at the same point, I was also repulsed by it. Now, maybe that is what the director wanted, and that's what Elroy wants the book to do.
Well, Bill, aside from The Black Dahlia, which, as we said, is being performed at the Yale Repertory Theater in New Haven, Connecticut, are there other stage noirs out there?
Well, I was racking my brains to try to come up with other stage noirs, and I can't come up with any real interesting noirs, stage noirs, before this one. You know, and I appreciate if people want to send in suggestions of other stage noirs, I'd be glad to hear them. Most of them tend to be more like gangster or mystery in the mystery genre, and that's not really noir. The thing that I think of, certainly in the most recently, was City of Angels, which is a musical, which was a very successful musical and played on Broadway. And that spoofed noir. I mean, that made fun of all the conventions that people had grown up with. So it seems to me that noir itself seems to be evolving. I mean, you either have the spoof of noir, as you had in City of Angels, or you have something like The Black Dahlia, which is taking what used to be noir and pushing it further and further into the sort of gothic horror,
that's right,
shockerama category.
Because film noir is so much about film. The color of it, the silvery black and white, the camera angles and all that.
Well, also it seems to me that film now has become so graphic, where you can see a lot of the things you couldn't see in the 30s and the 40s. I mean, it wouldn't dare show the kind of violent things they show in film today. So now in novels, it seems to me to keep a pace with that. You have to push the novels even harder. I mean, there's nothing this grisly in that you read in Black Dahlia or see on stage in the stage adaptation as you would read in a novel by Raymond Chandler or any of the other noir writers.
Challenging new play on the stage at the Yale Repertory in New Haven, Connecticut. Bill Marks, thanks for bringing us The Black Dahlia.
Thanks.
Here and Now's theater critic Bill Marks. For more information on The Black Dahlia, check out our website at here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll find out why some black ministers in Louisiana are so strongly endorsing the Republican candidate for governor.
And Philip Roth's masterful novel of sex and race in America's Summer of Monica, The Human Stain. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the 9 Democrats running for the White House say they'll boycott a straw poll in Florida. Florida's Democratic chairman says, come on down.
Florida is a microcosm of the nation, and certainly more representative than Iowa or New Hampshire.
And Arthur Gelb of the New York Times on the wild old days at the paper when the greatest character was the managing editor himself.
He was addicted to betting. He hired two bookies as clerks to take his bets and also take the bets of any reporter. And before long, I soon found myself betting on the horses.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. At least 16 people have been killed in the string of wildfires burning in Southern California. Rick Espinoza says much of San Diego County is at a standstill.
For the first time in 2 days, the city and county of San Diego are going to be opening their offices, but all schools in the county are still closed because the smoke is so thick. At the beach, some 40 miles away from the fires, the smoke is so thick that streetlights are coming on during the daytime. People are walking around with smoke masks. I have a respirator, and everybody, when you talk, you take your respirator off, and you have this ring around your mouth and your chin because you have it on so tight. Everybody has a chronic sore throat because you're breathing so much smoke so often. Rick Espinoza, Valley Center, California.
President Bush says after years of partisan deadlock over Medicare, Congress is on the verge of approving a reform measure. It will include coverage for prescription drugs. The president adds that a Medicare overhaul bill is within reach.
We have the opportunity. We have the obligation to give seniors more choices and better benefits. We have come far, and now is the time to finish the job.
Critics like Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle is warning that no bill may be better than a bad one. The U.S. post-war death toll in Iraq reaches a milestone, climbing to 117, more than those killed during the actual war. Two U.S. soldiers from the 4th Infantry Division were killed when their Abrams battle tank was disabled when it was struck by a landmine or a roadside bomb while on patrol near Baghdad. U.S. officials say attacks on coalition forces have increased to 33 a day in the past week. 7 Ukrainian troops were wounded south of Baghdad in the first ambush of a multinational unit. The International Red Cross says it will stay in Iraq but will cut back on its staff. The decision comes after Monday's suicide bomb attack at the gates of the compound in Baghdad. 2 Red Cross employees were killed and 10 others were wounded in the attack. The names of about 40 people who were included in the death toll in the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center are being taken off the list. City officials say they can't confirm their deaths or even whether they actually existed. Reports say the death toll in New York City will be changed from 2,792 to about 2,750. Wall Street at midday, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 8 points. The NASDAQ is down 3 points. The S&P 500 is down a fraction.